So this is May 14th, 2017. Going to be giving a Dharma talk this morning, and my topic is pain and happiness. So this topic sort of forced itself on me. There's a couple things going on that brought it to mind. The first is this program that the center just started doing, sort of an outreach program to people in the community called Hello Pain. We've done now two sessions of that. It happens on a Thursday evening out in the community space there behind the center. And we've got about this session, it's an eight-week session, about 15 or 16 people who are coming, and it's just a combination of various, I don't want to use the word methodology, but it comes into my head, so I'll say methods, different ways of dealing with chronic pain, intractable pain. And there's an awful lot that can be done, and there's a lot of research that backs it up. That there are ways of accepting our pain that make it much easier to live with it. And say a little more about that, obviously, as we go along. The other thing is there's an issue of Zenbo, not the next one, the long-awaited and much-anticipated mega issue on the 50th anniversary, the Zen Center's second issue with color photography. So don't miss that. But after that, there is another issue that already people have submitted their articles for, and it's on pain. And I submitted one myself, so it got me thinking. And not just, of course, not pain. The real issue is pain avoidance. You know, how we deal with our pain. And I'm going to be, in this talk, I'm going to be drawing from some materials on what's called acceptance and commitment therapy, or ACT. I think they're very happy with that little acronym there. And this form of therapy is actually one of the methods that's being used in the Hello Pain program. I was really introduced to ACT by my wife, who, among her many accomplishments, is a psychotherapist. And there's been some criticism of ACT that it's just basically warmed over Buddhism. But looking at it, I think that's actually a compliment. Buddhism is good, even second helping. So let me launch in here, and I'm going to start where the Buddha started. The Buddha's the Four Noble Truths. It's quite interesting that the Buddha's first teaching, sort of the foundational teaching of Buddhism, is life is pain. First of the Noble Truths. I used to always begin when I would give talks to high school classes or college classes or whatever, go out into the community. I used to always start off by running through the Four Noble Truths, but it doesn't really grab people. It can be kind of dry, and one of the reasons I think it was dry was that it was a little dry for me. I always kind of never really responded to, it seemed Buddhism sort of started out on a boring note. But the more I look at it and the more I experience it, the more I see how central it is, what a thorough diagnosis of the human condition is this first noble truth, that life is pain. Obviously, there are other translations. The Sanskrit word, as most people know, is dukkha, which can be also translated as suffering. The Chinese, when I read Sheng Yan and some of the other Chinese teachers, they tend to use the word vexation, which is another good word. Yeah, there's a lot of ways you can kind of get at it. Life just doesn't meet our expectations. So it's the point that's made is the pervasiveness of pain, the normality of pain, the central place that it holds. Bodhidharma said, to have a body is to be an heir to suffering and a stranger to peace. There's a lot of different sorts of pain. Of course, physical is the most obvious. And I was just spending some time with a two-month-old baby yesterday, and that physical pain comes right from the beginning. You know, the very first breath. There are people who claim to remember their birth, and evidently it's not pleasant. In fact, there's one fellow, Russell Williams, yeah, who says that the reason we fear death is that we know at some level that we're going to have to be born again. But so much of a baby, and I'm thinking of this one in particular, is just handling digestion. You know, you're sitting in the womb, everything is pretty groovy, and then all of a sudden, you know, there's no more placenta. You've got to do it yourself, more or less. And the GI tract isn't necessarily set up to do that. And so, you know, it's important to get burped. Just you see a lot of physical pain that just comes with the body. And, of course, we all experience it ourselves. But then beyond that, there's all the negative emotions, anxiety and anger and depression. Anxiety is some, and they come with their concomitant physical attributes. Anxiety, especially, I always get a chance to sort of dip into that lightly whenever I give a talk, and it's interesting to just feel those sensations and notice the reactions. You know, I guess I'm at a point where I can almost welcome it, and it's interesting to just see what does it feel like to have that little knot of anxiety on whatever level rising up. And where do we go with that? You know, does that touch off more pain, or does that focus the mind? There's so many different ways that we can react to our pain. And one of the things that happens in serious practice, in any practice, is that begins to shift, hopefully in positive ways. There's another concept that comes out of ACT, which is automatic negative thoughts, or ANTs, ANTs. They've got the acronyms really working pretty good for them there. So, yeah, we're all plagued by automatic negative thoughts. Wake up in the morning, and without even thinking about it, we're thinking about all the onerous things that we're going to have to do, starting with getting out of bed. Oh, I'm going to be so tired. I know that's not going to go well. Everybody's going to be bored with me. I don't think that way, but, you know. and then what do we do with them? You know, we hear from Roshi so often, they're just thoughts. They don't have any substance to them. But you need to remind yourself, because if you're on automatic pilot, negative thought comes into the mind, and we buy into it. We've all hopefully seen that bumper sticker that says, "Why believe your thoughts?" There is no good reason to believe your thoughts. Some of them may be true, but many of them are just noise. Maturity in practice is really learning to get some separation from our thoughts, to have some spacing. In ACT, this identification with our thoughts is called cognitive fusion. I'm not going to get into that. There's just too much. But I think that we deal with it in Zen practice by learning to have some distance from our thoughts, and by seeing them come up and in zazen, and by noticing how often they're poor predictors of the future. That difficult ordeal you were going to have to go through turns out to be okay. So why believe it the next time? Or that great experience you thought you were going to have turns out to be a disaster. I guess it could work either way. The second of the Buddha's Four Noble Truths is that the cause of pain is craving or desire. Roshi usually puts it egotistical craving or egotistical desire. What we call desire is also aversion. When we desire to avoid pain, and that desire to avoid pain tends to make it worse. In ACT, there's a distinction made between clean pain and dirty pain. Clean pain is the actual physical sensation. And dirty pain is all our reactions and contortions that come from trying to avoid taking in that clean, unavoidable pain. I've heard some criticism of the phrase clean and dirty because dirty is kind of pejorative, I guess. There are other ways of putting it. You could say simple pain and complex pain. In Buddhism, we talk about suffering on top of suffering. One thing that occurred to me thinking about this is that all pain at some level is clean pain. So let's say you're sitting in zazen and your legs hurt, and now you're torturing yourself with thoughts about how bad maybe it's going to get, or how long will the round go on. And you could say that suffering you're inflicting on yourself is dirty pain. But in any given moment, if you wake up to it and just see it plainly, That's what you're experiencing. That's reality. Your dirty pain is recycled as clean pain, and then the question is, where do you break the chain? You know, when do we stop flinching? When are we able to embrace it? So we become aware of any of these different kinds of pain, and we're always looking for a quick fix. And it's kind of sobering when you begin to sort of get a good look at your life and your habit patterns, your thought patterns, to see how much of your behavior, maybe other people aren't like this, but how much of my behavior is just chasing things that will make it better. Even if the pain is vague, just slight discomfort or boredom or, you know, feeling off or whatever, we're always looking for something to make it better, looking for a quick fix. And there are a lot of flavors to that. One of them is chasing praise and success, trying to be exemplary, trying to stand out. Other obvious ones are substance abuse, drinking or drugs. You know, on one level, almost every kind of quick fix is a kind of substance abuse, because even if you're just chasing praise or success, what you're really chasing is the good feeling you get when you are temporarily praised. It never lasts. And as we all know, one aw shit wipes out 100 attaboys. But that attaboy gives you a little squirt of dopamine, we now know. And so really we're getting that fix. We're getting our substance, even though it's endogenous, even though it's made by the brain itself. We contort ourselves and we do things to get that good feeling and to get rid of that bad feeling. And then it goes on to so many other things: TV, gambling, sleep, gossiping, just following the daily news. One of the more maladaptive ways to try to escape from pain. That sometimes one pain covers up another pain. And so we do it. Um, sort of our social norms, the way society is set up, really feed into this maladaption that we have, this trying to avoid pain, this unwillingness to look at it, to take it head on, to see what's there without flinching, without aversion, because pain is seen as not normal. There's this idea that everybody should be happy, that a human being, as long as everything, the basic needs are taken care of, should be normal, should be okay. And I want to read something. It's from an article called Embracing Your Demons, an Overview of Acceptance and Commitment Therapy by Russell Harris, who's evidently some guy in Australia, because this was published in Psychotherapy in Australia in August 2006. I'm sure a lot of my material here is out of date. It's a decade old, but I don't think people have changed too much since this was done. So there's a little section in there called Healthy Normality. He says this: Western psychology is founded on the assumption of healthy normality, that by their nature, humans are psychologically healthy and given a healthy environment, lifestyle, and social context with opportunities for, air quotes here, self-actualization, humans will naturally be happy and content. From this perspective, psychological suffering is seen as abnormal, a disease or syndrome driven by unusual pathological processes. Why does ACT suspect this assumption to be false? Well, if we examine the statistics, we find that in any year, almost 30% of the adult population will suffer from a recognized psychiatric disorder. And here he references a study. I won't go into all that. The World Health Organization estimates that depression is currently the fourth biggest, most costly, and most debilitating disease in the world, and by the year 2020, it will be the second biggest. Not sure if we're on track for that or not, but probably. In any week, one-tenth of the adult population is suffering from clinical depression, and one in five people will suffer from it at some point in their lifetime. Of course, clinical depression is depression that goes on for a considerable length of time and is associated with certain closely held thoughts. We all suffer from subclinical depression from time to time, at least everybody but bizarre outliers. But one in five will meet the criteria. And then furthermore, one in four adults at some stage in their lifetime will suffer from drug or alcohol addiction. There are now over 20 million alcoholics in the United States alone. More startling and sobering is the finding that almost one in two people will go through a stage in life when they consider suicide seriously and will struggle with it for a period of 2 weeks or more. I'm amazed by that. They reference some studies, so I assume it's just amazing to me that there's that many. But certainly we all know people who have struggled with those thoughts. It's a lot of suffering. Scarier still, 1 in 10 people at some point attempt to kill themselves. 1 in 10. So in this Zendo, maybe 4 or 5, if we are average. In addition, consider the many forms of psychological suffering that do not constitute clinical disorders: loneliness, boredom, alienation, meaninglessness, low self-esteem, existential angst, or angst, depending on your choice, and pain associated with issues such as racism, bullying, sexism, domestic violence, and divorce. Clearly, even though our standard of living is higher than ever before in recorded history, psychological suffering is all around us. And that doesn't even get into all the people suffering from physical pain, which is so common, especially as you get older. Don't get older, kids. So it's so pervasive, so normal, and yet we have this feeling that if we're not happy, then something is wrong. I saw there was recently an article just the other day in the New York Times talking about, which got into the difference between the face people present on Facebook and what you see if you delve into Google searches, you know, the things that people type into the Google search bar. So this is great. On social media, the top descriptors to complete the phrase, "my husband is," are the best, "my best friend," "amazing," "the greatest," and finally, "so cute." On Google, one of the top five ways to complete that phrase is also amazing, so that checks out. The other four, a jerk, annoying, gay, and mean. I have so much trouble now with Facebook. If you're my Facebook friend, I apologize. I haven't looked at it for nearly a month. I keep arguing with Chris about this. She keeps pointing out to me how helpful it is, and you know how you find out what's going on with your friends and see pictures of their babies. You know, it's great, but it's just that whole thing of presenting yourself to the world and all the weirdness that comes with it. I wouldn't want to be reading people's Google searches either, though. Yeah, the whole thing of comparing ourselves to others, it's deadly in Zen practice, and everybody does it. We all get killed. But there's a thing in AA which I never heard when I was, you know, spending a lot of time in AA, but I like it a lot. It's don't compare your insides to other people's outsides. So you see let alone Facebook, just in normal interactions, everybody is presenting themselves in what they hope will be a favorable light, for the most part. Sometimes people want to show their worst side, but there's always some calculation in there of what we present to other people, and that doesn't match up. Just like Facebook doesn't match up with Google, other people's outsides do not match up with our insides, and you know, it's basically everybody on one level or another is struggling. Everyone who has a body is an heir to suffering. A body and a mind, we could say. But we're so dialed into the whole idea of the pursuit of happiness. I mean, it's in our Declaration of Independence, right? It's central to the American identity. And what we're doing there is we're chasing an effect. You know, happiness comes up from other causes. It's anybody who's tried to be happy, it's kind of difficult. It's not how it works. It's just like I've heard it said that awakening, Kensho, is an accident. You know, all we can do is make ourselves accident prone. So what ACT therapy advises is, rather than pursuing a state of mind, rather than trying to dampen down negative feelings and amplify good ones, find what you value and work at that, and out of that comes relief from anxiety and from depression and from fear. I'm going to read a little bit from an article. It appeared in 2006. I guess this is when I clipped all this material. In Salon.com, the website, it's entitled "Getting Over Happiness." The writer, the reporter, is somebody named Rebecca Traister, and she interviewed Stephen Hayes. He's kind of the godfather of ACT therapy. She says in the beginning of her article, "Psychology has an improbable new rock star in Stephen Hayes, a 57-year-old University of Nevada professor whose newest book, Get Out of Your Mind and Into Your Life, co-authored with Spencer Smith, earned him a splashy profile in the February 13th edition of Time magazine. The arresting headline of the Time story was, "Happiness Isn't Normal." And while that's not a sentence Hayes actually wrote, it has quickly become the catchphrase associated with his controversial school of acceptance and commitment therapy. and so on. So she interviewed him, and what we have here is her questions and his answers. And once they've gotten past the fact that he didn't actually say happiness isn't normal, she asked him, so in part, you're redefining what happiness means. And he says, well, the word happiness does come from the headlines, so that's why I'm talking about it. What I would do with a client is help them learn what their values are. And values require definitions because there's not a lot in the culture about values. But it's not just a matter of redefinition. It's about changing the game. The natural game most of us are in is how to feel good. That's not the same thing as how to live good. We don't get good training in how to sit with pain anymore. We used to have spiritual traditions of fasting where you didn't eat even though you were hungry in order to connect with the suffering of other people. So that's something that we do here around Thanksgiving, a week, the Thursday, a week before Thanksgiving. Everybody here on staff and a lot of other members go for a day without eating just to be more in touch with the pain of people who don't have enough to eat and just to learn stuff about ourselves. Anyway, he says most of those traditions are gone. Now it's only the educated elite who go for 10-day silent meditation retreats who get that kind of experience. So I guess we're all part of the educated elite here. Then she says, but hasn't religious fasting been replaced with other kinds of self-inflicted punishment? And he says, yes, like the X Games and reality shows where you eat worms. That's about people going to the other extreme, seeking out of pain and thrills and challenges. There should be a middle path between suppression and indulgence. Middle path. Let's see, there's a little warmed over Buddhism in there. Western culture promotes feel-goodism. In part, it's a side effect of having technology to make things easier or feel better. It's natural progress, so we don't have to do the sweaty, hard things our forebears had to do. But inside that is a meta message, which is that you're supposed to feel good from morning to night. And add on top of that commercialism and medications, because they feed it too. If you consume the right products, eat the right pill, drink the right beer, drive the right car, you believe that you're not going to feel anything you don't like. What I'm saying is that is not the definition of a meaningful life, and I'm saying people know it. And she asks, but what's the line between sitting with pain and some kind of masochism or self-punishment? And he responds, well, it's also not healthy to say, to hell with your fear, leap off a tall building and see if the parachute opens up, you big sissy. A classic example of repressing your feelings in the interest of bearing up under pain is the military. You want to see spousal abuse and alcoholism? Go to a military base. Because that kind of just do it, you big sissy message destroys human lives. Doing things that don't feel good by denying your own feelings results in violence and substance abuse. What I'm saying is find a middle path. My work is about a loving posture. Accept your history. Feel your feelings. Notice your thoughts. And carry all that forward down a path that you value that's neither indulgence nor suppression. Right here I want to insert poem by the Sufi poet Rumi. Gets right at this. It's a poem called The Guest House. This being human is a guest house. Every morning a new arrival. A joy, a depression, a meanness. Some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Welcome and entertain them all. Even if they're a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house empty of its furniture, still treat each guest honorably. He may be clearing you out for some new delight. The dark thought, the shame, the malice, meet them at the door laughing and invite them in. Be grateful for whoever comes because each has been sent as a guide from beyond. Let them come in. Let them go out. It's our way. We learn patiently over time. Don't have to push it away. You don't have to cling to it. You don't have to argue your way out of it. See it, release it, and turn back to whatever is important to you. When we're sitting, we turn back to the practice. In our daily life, the practice is living our life, doing what's in front of us. Just to go on a little bit farther, she says, can you explain how your approach differs radically from cognitive therapy? And he says, most forms of empirically supported therapy have bought into the idea that the real problem in behavioral health is the presence of private events that are negative. This is like negative thoughts or feelings. Specifically with regard to cognitive therapy, which for 30 years has been ascendant in the field, the idea has been that you should monitor, detect, challenge, and change your negative thoughts. And when you do, you'll live better. But in a couple of randomized trials, that theory has shown not to be true, but it does not mention what those trials are, and I'm not sure if that's an undisputed fact or not. But just to get at his different approach, he says the radical difference here is that instead of a sequence in which you get your thoughts and feelings lined up and then live better, I'm saying to live better now, carry your thoughts and feelings with you. Don't have to argue with them. Could question them, ask whether do I really believe this or not, but it isn't necessary to refute it. See it. Let it be. The question is, what are we going to do? It says, our model of accepting your feelings, disentangling yourself from your mind, connecting with your values, showing up in this moment, and getting your feet moving in accordance with your values, it helps an amazingly broad array of problems, from chronic pain and epilepsy to doing well at work, anxiety, depression, substance abuse. She says, well, I have to say this moving in accordance with your values sounds sort of vague. I don't know that many of us could identify our values psychologically. And he says, well, we don't get much training in it. We get trained in what do you want. But what do you want leads to an object or feeling, and those aren't values. So what are they? They're not goals. They're nothing you can have like an object. They're an adverb, qualities of action. So when I say, what do you want your life to be about, I've never had somebody say, what I want is to be the driver of an SUV, or someone who screws everything that moves. What they tell me are things like, I want to contribute to other people, and I want to be a loving person. By saying it, you're connecting to it. But it's hard, because once you acknowledge it, you know it's not bullshit, and that it's not something you can ever stop doing. If you say that your values are being a loving person, do you ever get to say that's done? No. A value is like a direction, like going west. No matter how far west you go, you can still keep going west. And the instant you turn and start facing west, you're on the right path. There's a saying that somewhere the Buddha is still working on himself. Dogen said, there's no end to practice and beginning to enlightenment. There's no end to enlightenment and beginning to practice. Something like that. We face west and we keep going west. This whole question of figuring out what our values are and then making that the center of our efforts rather than trying to feel better, trying to get our negative feelings to go away, really lines up well with the whole issue of getting established and progressing in Zen practice. And I want to turn now to a little piece that was in the Shambhala Sun in September of 2010, written by Norman Fisher. He's a teacher, I think, in San Francisco, connected at least, connected with the San Francisco Zen Center. And his approach really is to look at what you value. I think it's a very good one. He says this: when people ask me how to get a home meditation practice started, here is what I tell them. The practice begins the night before. Before you go to sleep, set the alarm for a half an hour earlier than usual and say to yourself, tomorrow morning I'm going to get up to sit. I want to do this, and it is going to be pleasant and helpful. Hold that thought in your mind. Then as you fall asleep, say this: am I actually going to wake up early and meditate? And answer yourself, yes, I am. And then question yourself again, really? Take this seriously. Think a little more and answer yourself honestly. If the answer is, yes, really, then you will get up. You're serious about it. But if the answer is, no, I have to admit I am probably going to reset the alarm and turn over to get that delicious extra half hour of sleep, then save yourself the trouble. Reset the alarm now and don't even try to get up. This little exercise may sound silly, but it's very important. It addresses the main difficulty we have with self-discipline. We are ambivalent. We both do and don't want to do what we think we want to do in our own best interests. We find it difficult to take our good intentions seriously, especially when it comes to our spiritual lives. We have confusion at our core about whether we are capable of confronting ourselves at the deepest possible human level. Maybe if we do, we will find ourselves to be unworthy, trivial people. Since we imagine that meditation promises a self-confrontation at this level, we are deeply ambivalent. Most of this convoluted thinking is not conscious. This is why the before-bed self-dialogue is important. It provides a simple way of confronting the issue. Really. It's a way to surface what we really feel and gently and honestly deal with it. Otherwise, our lifelong habit of sneaky self-deception will likely prevail. We will not do what we're not really clear we want to do, which will give us further evidence that we can't do it. This is such an interesting process of getting ourselves established in doing what we value, in establishing any good habit. It's a long process, it really requires clarification of what we're trying to do. And we try to do a lot of things kind of half-heartedly. I think in this article, Norman Fisher says, maybe better if you're really, really deeply ambivalent not to try. Just wait for 7 or 8 years and then maybe you'll be ready. Maybe you need more pain. That'll do it. In fact, you know, I'm joking, but yeah, pain often is what brings people to practice. Sometimes it's difficult if practice resolves too much of the pain. The impetus may fade a bit, and then you need to go back to the well and think about what is it that I want to be doing. And there isn't any one answer. It's not like, you know, well, everybody needs to be Hakuin, everyone needs to be Dogen, everyone needs to be a spiritual hero. Everybody wants to be genuine. They want to be themselves. Advice is be yourself. Everyone else is already taken. there's a lot we can do to get over the hump, to get started. But then beyond that, we need to repeat, say in the case of sitting. We need to get to the mat on a regular basis over and over in order to get that to become a habit that's self-perpetuating. I was watching a documentary about a dog trainer down in Baton Rouge. It's called Dog Man. He says you need to train your dog for 34 days for him to be trained. Now, why 34? I think he's just looking for a number. It's sort of like 108 in Buddhism. It's just, you need to do it for a long time. And it's the same with ourselves. Anything that we do again and again and again gets its own momentum. We create a groove, in this case a positive pattern. But that consistency is what establishes it, and we really do undermine ourselves when we drop away. That being said, one of the biggest problems that I hear from people is a reluctance to get started back up because they've drifted away. Sort of touched on this a little bit. You know, this proves I'm not cut out for this because I've failed. Again, that's just a thought. It's probably automatic, and it's definitely negative. So it's one of those ants. We're always starting fresh. We always have an opportunity to do the first positive action in that chain that we hope to create, that we're working to create. There's nothing that can defeat us if we just shake it off and go back at it. Everything. Just to get over the fact that we're supposed to measure up to any kind of standard, to stop worrying about what our outsides look like, stop trying to worry about it, what our insides are like. And that's what they say, to be able to carry the pain and just move forward. Just to do it. It has an effect. It's so wonderful to have found any kind of spiritual practice, to have confirmed to whatever degree that this is a way that I can go. This makes a difference. This helps me. It helps the people around me. You know, I was thinking about his question of what do you value, and I think the first thing I would say is I want to be awake. I want to be present. I want to be not sleeping. And it's for the sake of all beings, so important that we just show up. And it's such a there's such a feeling of relief when we can let go of that job we've assigned ourselves of taking care of everything that doesn't feel good. Shifting and realizing that's not my job. That knot of anxiety is going to do whatever it's going to do. It won't stay. Nothing stays. Everything shifts and changes. Everything is that welcome guest. Anyway, it's great to be here with everybody facing west, and I'm going to stop now, and if anybody has anything they'd like to add or any question they'd like to ask, go ahead. Or we could just listen to the birds.
John, more actually more of an observation that I'd be interested in your comment on about pain. I have found that actually pain takes some concentration to experience. that defaulting to our thoughts about pain is so automatic that after some seconds of experiencing pain, it takes some attention to continue to experience that pain.
Yeah, because we're programmed to deflect it, to find a way out of it. And that's the wonderful thing about running into an optimal degree of physical pain in sitting. I say optimal because obviously it can be, too much, although it's pretty surprising when you're up against it how much we can handle. I'm not advising anybody to, twist themselves into the full lotus right now to get there, but I have to say how much I value experiences of pain that I've had that have gotten me to, because you have no other choice. When you're really dealing with pain, the deflection stops working and you run out of options. And opening up and keeping your attention there, breathing into it, becomes the best way of handling it. And it's quite a lesson to learn that that's the most effective way. All those other quick fixes end up failing. This one keeps working.
I have a question. Running through that process of deciding to sit in the morning, setting your alarm the night before, and if that last thought that goes through your mind is, nah, I'm not really, into this, I've found recently moving off of staff that I don't see that so much as ambivalence about a spiritual practice or a spiritual path, but sometimes just that it's commitment to being honest with myself about what I need. And so I don't always, I sit almost every morning, but there are mornings where I've decided that going for a walk is actually doing what's best for myself. And I wonder if that's more in line with some level of self-acceptance, rather than just kind of reframing as, well, I'm ambivalent and maybe in 6 or 7 years I'll come back to a spiritual path.
Yeah. I mean, taking a walk can be pretty spiritual, so I wouldn't. Yeah, if you're getting up in the morning and having, a double whiskey, that's although I suppose that could be a spiritual path. I didn't get enough chance to work on that before I stopped. I was a little ambivalent about reading from what Norman Fisher wrote, because he's really kind of trying to use thoughts to cajole yourself. But I think it's nice to just sort of gauge how, and by the way, whether you get up and sit in the morning or not is not the final measure of your commitment to practice. He's really into it. He feels the morning sitting, that's when everybody should sit. Some people, later in the day is fine. And I think we just do the best we can, and call an audible. Sometimes a walk. There's. Have you ever read that book, Bones of the Master?
Mm. Yeah.
It's a really fun book. And then the guy in that book, the teacher, who's Mongolian. His practice is keening. It's walking. That's all he does. You can Roshi Kaplan once told me, John, you can do Zazen standing on your head. As long as you're not taking a walk and just ruminating, that's practice.
You mentioned, the 12-step process there, and I'm just, especially with the inventory and then the rest of the steps. It seemed to me that fit just about everything you read there, because there is a process to it, just as we have our process in sitting. And sometimes in sitting, those issues arise, like you mentioned.
Yeah.
So I would like your comment on that. It seems to me that the two are very close together in this respect. That's why I'm here.
Yeah, and that may be how I found my way back as well. Yeah, they fit together, and Zen practice, I really think, helps. I sure felt like it helped me to really embrace the whole AA mm-hmm. experience. You know, the two fed off each other, sort of a virtuous circle. And I think it helps with therapy. You know, I think a lot of people have experienced that. You know, Roshi is a big fan of psychotherapy and recommended it to a lot of people and did it himself. And once you've learned to sit, you can really take things in. You've learned a way in. You know, learning. We're learning our way in, and it just applies to so many things. So, AA, ACT, Zen mm-hmm. practice, Buddhism. You know, they all seem to complement each other in a way. Yeah.
I was struck by your comments about suicide and some of the things that drive people to suicide, especially social opprobrium, being a person of color, being a person of a different sexual orientation or gender orientation, or being bullied.
Yeah.
For one of those reasons, or because some demagogue has set the thugs loose, or simple meanness, or that comes out of somebody else's pain. Mm-hmm. Dealing with those things in the context of sitting, the only thing I can say about sitting in that context is that sitting seems to be a kind of refuge. I was wondering if you had anything further to say.
Yeah, well, what comes into my mind is that openness is a refuge. You know, it's paradoxical, but, you know, sitting isn't turning away. It's an opening up, and it's just to suddenly find the support that's there in being able to take it in. You know, sitting is not a time when we work through, you know, thoughts. There's a place for that and a time for that, but it's a place where we get used to being struck by them, to feeling the pain, whatever it is. And the other thing I would say, though, is for many people in many situations, sitting is not enough, and there needs to be more. You know, the center used to sort of promote the idea, I think Roshi Kaplow felt this way, that if you just went deep enough into Zazen, you could take care of all those problems. And I think more is often needed for whatever reason. And,
What part of what this brings to mind is there have been several occasions in which the Sangha, we corporately as well as individually, were surprised by somebody's suicide, by it being so hard for someone that they did themselves in. Right under our nose, or soon after leaving the center, or something, or while away from the center.
Yeah. But it's everywhere. Mm-hmm. It's on college. Yeah, we don't see other people's insides, and a lot of people are in a lot of pain. The more people there are in this world who are clear and open and compassionate, you know, the more hope there is for everybody. We all depend on other people to help us out.
But paradoxically, though, when we sit, you know, I own it, when I sit, I do face a lot of that. I face my own biases, my prejudices, and how painful they are. And yeah, I know their thoughts, and you know they, you know, but somehow when they arise, I know something changes in me, and it's not that I avoid the pain of those things, but yet there's something that arises out of that. That I guess it's like the Rumi poem.
Mm-hmm.
The house is open when I sit.
Yeah.
And all this shit comes into my head.
Right? Yeah, and when you're sitting.
Then somewhere in it, it starts to settle, and the doors are open again. It's such a paradox that sometimes I don't see myself like just an example. I had to admit there was a little bit of Trump in me. I hated it, but there it was, you know. Not happy with it, but yeah, there's some biases there that you know, that, bam, you know, it's like a dope slap in a way. It's Jerry, yo. It's such a paradox, this practice. I like that. Keep going west.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. That's all we have to do.
Will be revealed.
Right. We'll get our instructions later. Okay. Well, we're past our stopping point, so we'll probably stop now.
All beings without number, I bow to the great endless blind passions. I bow to uproot dark gates beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the meridian way of Buddha. I bow beings without number, I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot dark gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain. Without number, I bow to liberate endless blind passions. I bow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha.